I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. Bahrain, like several other countries in the Middle East and North Africa, has been shaken by protests, but this uprising has been largely ignored by Western media outlets. A number of human rights activists have received harsh prison sentences, newspapers have been shut down, and reporters have been deported. So why is there such little media interest in Bahrain? Award-winning journalist Reese Ehrlich recently returned from Bahrain. He received a visa to go there and was able to visit places where many journalists have a hard time reaching. His pieces have run in places like NPR and Global Post. Reese Ehrlich is the author of Conversations with Terrorists, and he joins us here in studio. Hi, Reese. Nice to see you.
Good to be here.
Thanks for coming in. And President Obama's major cabinet appointments are receiving major media attention, but where's the focus? The nomination of Republican Chuck Hagel to the position of Secretary of Defense has come under criticism for allegedly negative comments on Israel. But where are the reports about his record? Alex Seitz-Wald reports that the charges of comments on Israel are little more than a partisan smear. Meanwhile, there has been little scrutiny of John Brennan's ascension to head the CIA, even though he was forced to withdraw his name from consideration for the same job back in 2008 because of his alleged involvement with the Bush-era torture programs. Alex Seitz-Wald is Salon's political reporter, and he has been writing extensively about these issues. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to reporters who did a good job this week. So, Alex, why don't we start off with you? Where did you see a piece this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there's so many wonderful pieces out there. It was hard to choose.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
I have to give a shout-out to my colleague, Irene Carmon, who had a great piece about how social media is changing the way that women can report sexual assault against them. You know, there's always a problem of underreports of that. So really wonderful piece at Salon. And then also at Mother Jones, my friend Andy Kroll on a new initiative among liberal groups to try to combat voter ID laws and expand the right to vote.
I'm particularly interested in the piece about social media and violence against women. Can you talk a little bit about more about this? There's a group called Holla Back, where women take photos of men who, assault them or give them catcalls on the street and then post it on websites.
Yeah, exactly. It's efforts just like that. Just other the ways that you can share things a lot easier, and you can start out sharing things anonymously, and then as you get more comfortable and you trust sources, you can reveal more about your identity. But, you know, as anyone who's looked at this issue knows, one of the biggest problems is that there's so many incidents that go unreported. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most men, I think the statistic is something like most rapists will have 6 victims in their lives because the first victim often doesn't report the incident.
Right.
So if we can increase the, rate of reports with different efforts like this, then you can stop them after the first one and, hopefully prevent future assaults.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up because on Monday we're going to open the lines to air our concerns about sexual assault and violence to talk about what we experience on a regular basis. In San Francisco, there have been 3 recent reported rapes and random violent attacks just in the last week. And today at 4:00, there's going to be a solidarity march to keep our streets safe. 4:00, meet up at Mission and 16th at the BART station. And the plan is to walk around the Mission in act of solidarity to really talk about these issues and talk about how we should respond. So thank you so much for that. And what about you, Reese? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I found a really good article in The Guardian, the British newspaper, called Syrian Rebels Sidetracked by Scramble for Spoils of War. And the reporter spent a number of weeks in Aleppo, which is very hard to do these days and quite dangerous, and reported that the squabbling among the rebel forces, a lot of it has to do with divvying up the spoils and who's going to seize what in the parts of Aleppo that they control. So it makes clear that the brutality of the Assad government, but also the disarray among at least some of the opposition forces.
It was shocking to read a couple of days ago that the UN estimates at least 60,000 lives have been lost just in the last 2 years in Syria.
Yeah, it's hard to know if that figure's accurate or not. It jumped up from 45,000 suddenly to 60,000. Those are guesstimates. Mm-hmm. And we probably won't know until there's some kind of a actual survey done under conditions that can't be done right now. But for sure, tens of thousands of people have died unnecessarily.
It's horrific. I mean, you report extensively from the region. Where do you go for really good on-the-ground journalism about, you know, place, for example, what's happening in Syria?
Well, you have to search a lot because most reporting is done out of Beirut. So, for example, the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, they have their bureaus in Beirut covering, and they're monitoring websites and video posted on YouTube, and they make some phone calls, and then they report it. Well, that's at best a scattered, incomplete, and sometimes inaccurate description, and they tend towards the rebels are the good guys and the government is the bad guys.
Right.
The Guardian gives somewhat better coverage. Anybody who can get somebody in and on the ground. On the other side, you can watch Press TV to get the pro-Assad government side. It's important to see what they have to say because occasionally there's some truth in what they report, although it's largely propaganda.
And this is run by the Iranian regime.
That's right. And Al Jazeera is on the other side because it's based in Qatar, which is very much opposed to Assad. They have extensive reports from the rebels and nothing but nasty things to say about the government. So, as with any of these international crises, you need to get to as many sources as you can.
And that's award-winning investigative journalist Reese Ehrlich, who is just back from Bahrain. Why did you decide to go to Bahrain? You got a visa, and you were able to get to places where a lot of journalists are having a hard time reaching.
Yeah, it's. I had been interested in going there since February and March of 2011, when the uprising began there, if you recall. Tunisia and Egypt had overthrown their repressive governments. The people of Bahrain came out in over a million in demonstrations. The country, over 100,000. The country has 1.3 million people. So something like 15% of the Bahraini population came out in demonstrations. That's huge. So I had tried to get in at that time, was unsuccessful, and had basically tried for about a year. And I was finally able to get a visa. I think in the view of the government, things had calmed down so they could allow foreign reporters to come in. There were a few other foreign reporters there that I ran into. And you don't know what you're going to be able to cover, so you just go out and try it. Mm-hmm. And if somebody stops you, well, then you try a different way. And so I was able to make contact with opposition forces, with human rights groups, with pro-government people. And I went out to some of the areas. You know, all demonstrations have been banned in Bahrain since October of last year, but still at least over 100 that I could find had actually taken place anyway, including some over 10,000 people. That's big when the demonstrations are completely outlawed and you're attacked immediately by the police. So I got to a village and interviewed people, and within 5 minutes of a rally starting, we were all attacked by the police.
Wow.
Luckily, I was able to run fast enough to get out of the line of fire.
And how are you received? And what do the people, what stories do they want you to tell?
Oh, in Bahrain, as is the case in lots of other countries facing this kind of repression, they love to see foreign reporters because it's their communications line to the outside world. So once I made contact with one human rights activist, I was getting phone calls. I was fending off emails from people who wanted me to tell their stories, and I couldn't report all of them, but I did as many as I could. And so they're very anxious. And interestingly enough, they're particularly interested in me as an American reporter because they understand the role the U.S. plays in Bahrain. The Fifth Fleet of the U.S. Navy is based there. The U.S. historically has supported the monarchy there. It continues to downplay the human rights violations, the arrests, the detention, the repression of demonstrations, torture, all documented quite thoroughly, acknowledged by the United States. But because it's a pro-U.S. regime, it's the attitude is, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. That's not a good thing to be doing. But we urge negotiations. Whereas in Syria, it's overthrow the Assad brutal dictatorship. In Iran, overthrow the brutal Iranian regime. You know, the U.S., have I noted in the past, is slightly hypocritical on these issues.
Right. And Alex, I'd love to bring you in on this because it would be great if the media would raise some of these issues when talking about Chuck Hagel's nomination to become Secretary of Defense. But I mean, I've listened to a lot of radio reports this week, and most of the attention is about Israel. I mean, you're not getting any questions about what Reese just raised.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really unfortunate. And I mean, there's a concerted campaign among some in Washington, you know, who called the neoconservatives the kind of Bush foreign policy holdovers, especially from the American Enterprise Institute, a big conservative think tank here, to make Israel an issue. And not that it shouldn't be. I mean, I personally don't think so, but I think it's fair for critics to raise concerns. But there are so many other issues out there, like Bahrain and the Fifth Fleet there. And I mean, you could pick dozens of issues across the globe, and things even closer to home that need to be addressed. And we're just getting none of that because it's all being kind of pushed aside by this campaign on Israel.
What are your thoughts on that? Reese, what explains this?
Well, I continue to be amazed that Chuck Hagel has somehow become a paragon of liberalism and progressive anti-interventionism. I mean, this guy was a conservative Republican. He voted for the Iraq War. He voted. He's raked over the coals for his positions on Iran. But all he said was, "You can't have unilateral U.S. sanctions. You know, it has to be get cooperation from U.S. allies." I mean, that's hardly some kind of a radical position. And yet, the right wing is going ballistic over trying to get him not nominated, as they did over Susan Rice, right? So this is not really about Hagel and his policies. It's about, can they find a vehicle to attack Obama? And they're probing, and they try it, and so they're hoping that this is one more way to discredit the Obama administration.
And we'll continue talking about that, but back to Bahrain and what you found there. So earlier this week, 13 activists received prison sentences ranging from 5 years to life. The session lasted only 13 minutes. You've got newspapers being shut down. Reporters are being deported. What else do we need to know about what's happening there? Because we're getting such little media attention.
Yeah, they add to that, 31 activists and leaders had their citizenship taken away, which means they have no more government benefits. They can't practice law. They can't leave the country because their passports are no longer valid. I mean, there's just a series of repressive actions by the monarchy. Keep in mind, they've had the same prime minister now for 42 years. You know, an example of emerging democracy, presumably. The newspapers do report it. It's not like it's a complete silence, but it's in the back pages. It's not highlighted. There's no editorials in the New York Times. And that's because neither high-level Democrats nor high-level Republicans in Washington are making an issue out of it. If suddenly somebody wanted to make a big deal about it, the newspapers and media here would pay more attention to it. So what constitutes media coverage is driven a lot by the debate in Washington, not the reality on the ground.
And that is Reese Ehrlich, who's just back from Bahrain. He's the author of Conversations with Terrorists. His pieces have been published in Global Post. He also had two pieces in NPR. You can find his work at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Alex Seitz-Wald. He is Salon's political reporter. And his latest piece is John Brennan, the nominee who should be controversial. He says Chuck Hagel's getting flack, but we should debate the CIA nominee, a veteran of Bush-era torture policies. You can also find his piece on our website. And what are your thoughts on these issues? They're both connected because we've got nominations to the CIA and the Department of Defense. This is a great time for the media to be asking very important questions about the future of U.S. foreign policy, about what's happening in the Middle East. But like we said, so much of the debate about Chuck Hagel is focused on what past comments he has made about Israel. So what are your thoughts about that? Where have you seen good coverage of these issues? And if you have any questions for Reese about what he saw on the ground in Bahrain, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if there was a story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, please feel free to call in or email it to us. You can also post it to yourcallradio.org. So, Alex, Reese just said that one of the reasons why we're not hearing these questions is because what we see in the media is based on what we hear in Washington, on the debate in Washington. We talk about this a lot on our Friday shows. What are your thoughts on that? And what are the responsibilities of reporters to bring those questions to the debate?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the byproducts of this focus on Israel, and I would guess an intentional byproduct, is to push all these other issues aside. I mean, the same people who are leading the campaign against Hagel on Israel are the same people who were either directly involved or supported the kinds of Bush-era torture programs and detention programs that are the questions that should be raised about John Brennan. So by distracting all the attention on Hegel and Israel, they're kind of sucking the air out of the room to have these other discussions, and thus, you know, protecting their legacy. Because the thing with Brennan, what we should be discussing and what he raises is that the Obama administration has adopted the vast majority of the Bush administration's controversial tactics that he suggested he would fight against, and that, you know, the change we can believe in, that was one of the big things. It's hard to remember now because the liberal movement has seemed to stop caring about civil liberties in such a large degree, but this was a core issue in 2006 in the big election that gave Democrats control of the House and Senate, and then in 2008 in Obama's first election. And he won the Democratic primary by opposing, being the candidate that had opposed the Iraq War, fought the Bush administration, unlike Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, he comes into office and appoints Brennan, who had been a top staffer at the CIA, who was the chief of staff to George Tenet, the guy who, you know, basically told us that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And then he brought him over to the White House, where he's escalated the drone program. So, you have kind of a funny situation where the neocons who don't want to talk about this stuff because it's their legacy are distracting about Hegel. And I think the White House is just as happy to engage on that debate, because then they don't have to talk about the uncomfortable reality of how they've adopted all these programs that they said they were going to dismantle.
Well, right. And so you're talking about people who have long track records, and some of them under George W. Bush. So, Reese, what would you say when you're talking about reporting from Bahrain or Syria, what changes in policies do you see between the Obama administration and the Bush administration?
Oh, very little. Very little difference. Particularly on foreign policy, I think maybe on some domestic policies there's differences. But particularly the second Bush administration, that is the second 4 years, they had already shifted away from some of the neoconservative and interventionist policies, because they weren't working. It was costing too much money, too many people were dying, and the wars were too unpopular. So Obama very much carried out Bush's second term. So you look at drones, they've upped the number of drone attacks tremendously. They started a new war in Pakistan. There were some elements of it under Bush, but Obama has actually started a full-scale war, which is part of the reason we see such horrible violence and fighting going on in Pakistan today. It decided to intervene in Syria, not with a direct military intervention, but with providing arms to the people and political support to the people the U.S. likes. So on all of these counts, that's exactly the story. And, of course, continue to keep Guantanamo open and detain people without trial. And they're fighting like heck in the courts. The courts have ruled against the Obama and Bush administrations on some of their legal maneuvers to keep people in jail. And the Obama administration is going to fight it, even though they've know that's been ruled against them.
Right. And that was also part of the military spending bill, which we talked about yesterday, although we didn't get to talk about the Guantanamo piece of that bill, which, again, will prohibit the closure of Guantanamo for at least another year.
Yeah. The irony is that the U.S. criticizes the Afghan government for releasing people that the U.S. has jailed in Afghanistan. And the Afghan government says, you don't have any evidence. We don't have any evidence to keep people in jail. And the U.S. says, it doesn't matter. You have to keep them in jail anyway. This sounds like a strange argument.
That is Reese Ehrlich, investigative reporter who just returned from Bahrain. We're also joined by Alex Seitz-Wald. He's Salon's political reporter. What about U.S. foreign policy in Bahrain? Again, a major U.S. ally. Mm-hmm. How has that changed, if at all, under the Obama administration?
Oh, I don't think it's changed at all. There's a slight emphasis on emphasis on human rights. But Bush would give verbal, comment as well, as long as you didn't have to actually do anything. The key thing to look at all the countries in the Middle East, including Bahrain, is where's the oil? How does the oil get out of there? And what is their attitude towards the U.S. military in the region? And what is their attitude towards the so-called war on terrorism? Those are the key issues that the U.S. evaluates. And Bush and Obama have the same policies, which is you got to support the countries that are pro-U.S. that have oil. You got to make sure they can get the oil out through shipping lanes or pipelines. And then you have to make sure the military is there to guarantee the shipping lanes and the pipelines. Obama is the same no changes. Again, the occasional verbal joust with criticizing the government, but not doing anything about it.
And, Alex, we have an email from Bruce in Monterey. He says what no one is mentioning is that, as in 2008, the people Obama have chosen to run the government are the exact same people that his presidential opponents would have nominated for these positions had he lost these elections. Obama was compared to FDR when the president he most closely resembles is Ronald Reagan. What are your thoughts about Bruce's opinion about his appointments?
Well, a lot of that's true. I mean, he kept Bush's defense secretary, at first kept a lot of senior positions in the CIA and the intelligence agency. And, you know, to give him some credit, I think a lot of that was political. Democrats have this knack for being, or not for being, you know, soft on defense, soft on terrorism. So in order to kind of cover from attacks from Republicans on that, he kept a lot of these Bush holdovers in place on the security side, you know, whereas you had on the domestic politics side, on economic side, you had an entirely new brand of people. But yeah, it's absolutely true. And as Reese was saying, I mean, on foreign policy, it's really hard to find significant differences between the Bush and Obama administrations. Yes, he ended the torture program, and he should be praised for that. But on so many other things, he's kept them the same, or even, you know, made things worse, like with the drone program. And we just had the FISA Amendment Act, which codifies, it says it's okay for the government to essentially spy on people, you know, tap their phones and read their emails without a warrant. There was a number of Democratic senators who tried to introduce some very modest reforms to that in amendments, and because of pressure from the Obama administration, it sailed through in the last minute, right before it was going to expire at the end of December, without any amendments. So, unfortunately, there really hasn't been much progress.
I would just add one quick thing on the torture program. The Obama administration eliminated torture by the army, like we saw in Abu Ghraib in Iraq, but explicitly allows torture to be continued by the CIA. So it's back to the status quo ante prior to Bush's expansion of the torture programs. There's absolutely nothing that says the CIA can't detain, you know, the extraordinary rendition, torture, etc. That's all still perfectly okay as far as Obama's concerned.
So does this mean that people are being transferred from one country to another to be tortured?
Yeah, we don't hear, the answer is yes. We don't hear much about it because they've toned it down. They haven't done it as widely as before, but it's perfectly, and it was explicit in the torture statement made by Obama that the CIA could continue to do it.
And the black sites, are those still in operation?
I think they are.
That is investigative reporter Reese Ehrlich, who recently returned from Bahrain. He received a visa and was able to visit places where many journalists have a hard time reaching. His pieces have run in Global Post and NPR. He's the author of Conversations with Terrorists. We're also joined by Alex Seitz-Wald. He is Salon's political reporter. He's been writing about coverage of John Brennan to head the CIA and Chuck Hagel to head the Defense Department. This is getting a lot of attention, and these issues are all very connected. This is a really good time for the media to have a conversation about U.S. foreign policy and where this is heading. But what are your thoughts about where the focus is? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you have a question for Reese about what he saw in Bahrain, we'd love to hear from you. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
Recommended on the Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. You can also highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by joining the conversation. Call 866-798-8255 or send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday again, we will open the lines to air our concerns about sexual assault and violence. Every 2 minutes, someone is sexually assaulted in the U.S. More than half of those assaults are not reported. A number of recent violent attacks in San Francisco are receiving widespread attention. In fact, on Wednesday, at the Divisadero and Haight Street bus stop, a woman was assaulted with a stun gun. Someone was trying to steal her phone. So we're going to talk about what's happening. And then today there is a solidarity rally kicking off at 4 o'clock at the 16th BART station in the Mission District. You can find more information about this on our Facebook page. Again, it's 4 o'clock at the 16th Street Mission BART station in San Francisco to speak out about this violence and talk about how we should respond. That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you today. What are your thoughts about media coverage of the nominations to the CIA and the Department of Defense? What about Bahrain? Reese Ehrlich just got back from Bahrain. It's not receiving that much attention. There is major crackdowns happening. Human rights activists are receiving harsh prison sentences. Newspapers are being shut down. Reporters are being deported. Award-winning journalist Reese Ehrlich just returned from Bahrain. He's author of Conversations with Terrorists. And we're speaking with Alex Seitz-Wald, Salon's political reporter, about media coverage of John Brennan and Chuck Hagel's appointments. And if you'd like to weigh in on what you've seen this week, what questions do you think reporters should be asking on these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you'd like to talk about a story you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning, Alex and Reese, your guests. I want to bring up an article that was in the review section, the Sunday Times, The Quality of Mercy Strained by the Editorial Board. And it goes into Mr. Obama and the amount of presidential pardons he's given. And he is the worst president in presidential pardons, 22 people pardoned in 4 years since 1900. Only one out of every 50 applicants gets a pardon. And under George W. Bush, it was one out of 33. Under Bill Clinton, it was one out of eight applicants. And even Ronald Reagan, who Mr. Obama has said he models himself after, and this was 12/14, December 4th, Radio Notices, Univision 23, he said he would be a Reagan Republican if you matched, you know, what his policies are.
Right.
One out of three applicants. He is even further to the right than Ronald Reagan. I mean, let's get this straight. This guy is a right-winger. Let's have, and John Brennan, I mean, you can't get more of a torture guy than this guy. Renditions, torture, drones, nobody injured, nobody killed, no civilians killed. I mean, this is complete as far fascism. This guy is a fascist, John Brennan, a pure fascist. Have your guest comment. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I don't think you should loosely throw around the term fascist. That's a very serious, because this country has faced extreme threats, and I don't think John Brennan represents that. I think he represents the right wing of the defense and CIA establishment in this country, and you're right that Obama is adopting many of the policies of the Republican right wing. On the question of the quality of mercy, it's a very good point, because when liberals are in power, they often fear that if they pardon somebody and then that person goes out and commits a new crime or causes controversy, they're going to be attacked for it, whereas the conservatives, to the extent that they do the pardoning, realize that their right flank is already covered.
Well, thank you for this. I just also found a piece in The Nation called Why Has Obama Pardoned So Few Prisoners? Under Clinton, it was 100. President Bush, 100. To date, Obama has pardoned less than 24 and commuted even fewer sentences. I had no idea this was happening. So thank you so much for bringing this to
our
attention.
Yeah, same thing with Jerry Brown in California. The liberals have awful records on this stuff.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Andy. And let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a good program as usual. I have a question about the situation in Mali. I just read the UK Guardian that the French and perhaps other European countries or countries bordering Mali in North Africa have sent troops. Do you have any more information on that? I'd like to hear about that. Thank you very much. I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Max.
By way of background, Mali is a country in the northern part of Africa, below the Arabic North African countries. And there was a coup d'etat there, and Islamist forces and Tuareg, which is a ethnic group, forces took over the north of the country. And it's been pretty much in chaos now for about a year. My understanding is that the French and some African countries are planning to send in troops to Mali, but they have not yet sent them, unless this is just something that happened.
It just happened because Reuters is reporting that France's armed forces began a military intervention today.
Oh, so this is all new.
Yes.
All right. So,
the President François Hollande said this operation will last as long as necessary.
Yeah, it's another one of these situations that's quite murky, because the reason the country is in crisis is the pro-Western military pulled a coup against their own government, which was not no paragon of democracy, but at least it was elected, and that's what's kicked off the crisis. So foreign troop interventions might temporarily restore order in some parts of the country, but then who's going to run the country once that takes place? And that's the question that's never asked. The French troops, I'm sure, are militarily much more capable than the insurgents, but are they going to stay forever?
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for calling on this, Max, and we'll keep an eye on it. And Alex, before we let you go, I just wanted to ask you, at a time when these nominations are being done, and there's just such a good time to have a debate about all of these issues, what questions do you think the media should be asking?
Well, I think the questions are, fairly clear about drone program and the legal precedent underpinning it, about FISA. So much of what goes on is secret, and this is an opportunity to ask them. But I have to say, I put a little bit of blame here on liberals and progressives, as I consider myself to be one, because we've kind of abandoned this issue. It was a critical issue under the Bush administration, maybe one of the top three or top five issues that liberals cared about. And then as soon as Obama got in office, we ceded it. And the media, is going to write stories that sell generally.
Right.
I don't think that's an indictment, but they are a for-profit entities for the most part. And if people, if no one's interested in reading about these things, then they're not going to write them. So, and it's been interesting. I've been tracking closely any progressive action against John Brennan, and there's been very little. A group called Credo, which is based in San Francisco, there's a cell phone company that they do a lot of grassroots activism. And another group called Demand Progress, which is a civil rights organization, just yesterday they launched a campaign against Brennan. But I've talked to some of the Democratic senators who are very big on civil liberties, and they're not particularly eager to go after him. So I think what needs to happen is for progressives to make their voices heard and to call their senators, call their congressmen, and to get them to do something, and then the media will respond to that. Because unfortunately, that's the only way that you're going to get the media to actually pay attention to this.
Well, and you point this out in your piece that 2 weeks ago, the Senate quietly reauthorized the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Amendment Act, which codifies warrantless wiretapping and email snooping with little debate and no amendments. And then again, we did a show about military spending yesterday. The $633 billion bill passed the Senate 98-0. That rarely happens. Little to no debate. Hardly any. I didn't hear a peep really on Facebook from progressives who would have said something under the Bush administration. Just quickly, Reese, do you think that the media would respond if progressives were talking about these issues?
For sure. I think occasionally there's enterprise reporting from the major media. One of the ways the FISA issue got exposed was a big investigative story by the New York Times that was delayed for a long time and finally published. And so occasionally they'll do things on their own. But yes, they respond. If there's a debate by some high-level Democrat or Republican, and suddenly that becomes a front-page issue as opposed to a back-page issue. So, and after ignoring the Occupy movement in the initial weeks, it became front-page news when it gathered enough steam, and the major media were forced to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, Alex, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a piece on gun control right now, looking at the history of the Third Reich, actually. If you talk to gun control activists, they often, one of the first talking points that comes out is how Hitler disarmed the country before he took over, before he executed the Holocaust. That turned out to be totally untrue. So just trying to correct the history on that.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll look for it. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. That is Alex Seitz-Wald. He is Salon's political reporter, and you can find his pieces about John Brennan and Chuck Hagel at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar, and it's our media roundtable. Reese Ehrlich is an award-winning journalist, author of Conversations with Terrorists, just returned from Bahrain. And now I would like to welcome Paul Keel to the show. Paul is an award-winning investigative reporter with ProPublica, and he's been reporting on another issue that's not getting much attention, and that is the ongoing foreclosure crisis. Paul reports that as the sixth year of the foreclosure crisis comes to an end, the percentage of loans in foreclosure remains a staggering eight times higher than it was in 2005. 5.3 million homeowners, about 11% of all borrowers, are behind on their payments. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you and your colleagues at ProPublica have done really great reporting on the foreclosure crisis. Why do you think this is getting such little attention these days?
Well, I mean, when attention does come, it tends to be because the government has finally come to some sort of settlement over the robo-signing scandal. And I think that's kind of context for the way the whole crisis played out, where there was really the government efforts to intercede in the crisis were limited to basically a large program by the Obama administration that they launched at the beginning of 2009. It didn't go very well, and part of that was there wasn't much political will in Congress to do something that was really sizable. And nothing was really done to fix that program until the robo-signing scandal in 2010, because the banks were such a mess that they couldn't, they actually had to stop their foreclosures because they had been filing, false statements in courts all over the country. And it's only after that point that the government really stepped in with anything you might call, major, action. There was a settlement that they struck last year, and then there's a settlement that was announced this week that ended a review process the bank regulators were doing. So it's sort of a process that has only involved real action from government when their hand was forced by things getting such to a such a dismal point that they had to step in.
And again, ProPublica has a comprehensive media package about this. You've got a database of homeowners who faced foreclosure, a Facebook page encouraging homeowners to share their stories. There are several profiles of these people, and you've incorporated their experiences into your reporting. What has really changed over the past 6 years?
Well, what's changed, probably the best development is that the economy has gotten better. So you have fewer people falling into foreclosure. And the banks have improved a little bit by a little bit. I think there are a few people falling into delinquency, so things are not quite at the crisis level they were in 2009 and early 2010, which is really the height of the crisis. One improvement there has been, I think, a little bit due to government intervention, but it has been kind of a story of very little, kind of structural change over that time.
And let's talk a little bit about your piece about the Independent Foreclosure Review, because this is so fascinating and so bizarre. You report that it was supposed to be a full and fair investigation of the big bank's foreclosure abuses, and it was trumpeted as the government's largest effort to compensate homeowners, victimized homeowners. Federal regulators who designed the review forced the banks to spend billions of dollars to carry this out. Millions of homeowners were eligible. Hundreds of thousands submitted claims. But on Monday morning, the very regulators who launched the program 18 months ago announced that it had all been a massive mistake and shut it down. So first, can you give us some background on this?
Right. So this is what I was describing. The robo-signing scandal led to finally some government intervention and the problems that had kind of been really widespread and widely reported, dating back to early 2008, with the fact that people were ending up in foreclosure, and those foreclosures could have been avoided if the banks had not been quite the mess that they were. And so what the banking regulators do, and this is you know, this is different from the settlement last year because that was basically law enforcement on the state and federal level. These are banking regulators who oversee the banks. And they decided, well, let's kind of go through and let's create a process where we will systematically review loans and determine who really was harmed and then send checks out to those people, those homeowners, whether they lost their homes or not. These are people who are in foreclosure at the height of the crisis. And they'll get checks that reimburse them for, you know, basically compensate them for their harm. And the checks were going to go up to $125,000 and kind of down to maybe just a couple $100s, depending on what harm there was. And to do that, the regulators required banks to hire these outside companies that were supposed to be independent. And that's the process that was launched in the middle of 2011. People could start sending in claim forms, these four-page obviously written by a lawyer. More than 4 million of these were sent out to people. The response was very low for, I think, some pretty obvious reasons. One, people didn't trust the process because they didn't trust the bank, particularly after what they've been through. Two, it was like obviously 4 pages of something that had obviously been written by a lawyer, hard to understand for a lot of people. And it just, they maybe hadn't heard about this process before. They get some letter in the mail. They don't know what it is. There's nothing on the form that says, hey, you could get money through this or list what the possible rewards could be. So I think a lot of people didn't find it worth their time. The response was really low. Ultimately, there was about 4.4 million letters sent out. Only about 500,000 people ultimately sent in a form, and that was only after they made a big advertising push, the banks did at the end of this last year, that bumped up the numbers a little bit. But obviously, you know, 500,000 out of 4.4 million is not a major response.
Right, and then you report that 10 banks have agreed to pay a total of $3.3 billion in cash to 3.8 million borrowers who had been eligible for the review. That's only 870 per borrower.
Right. Well, and the background to this is that the reviews had dragged on for more than a year and a half. Nobody had gotten, there had been no money that had gone out to homeowners after all this time. The consultants had been paid in aggregate over $1.5 billion to do these reviews. And we did stories showing that, you know, and not, they were not really independent reviews because in the case of Bank of America, for instance, they actually had their own employees doing analyses of the loans and sending them to the consultants who would kind of start with that as their starting point. We call it a kind of cheat sheet, which doesn't really sound like an independent process. So there are all sorts of problems with the process. And kind of the rationale, the regulators, when they unveiled this, is like, yes, we are admitting that this process was a big mistake, but their defense for it is, you know, at least people will get some money now quicker. They're basically doing kind of a slapdash review process. It's not really a review. They're just kind of putting people in the different categories and then assigning them all the same amounts. And those amounts apparently will range widely. You'd expect people who lost their home to get more than people who might have, you know, been in foreclosure and managed to stay in their home. But the details haven't been released yet.
Yeah, and of course, again, asking this important question, how independent are these consultants if they're actually working for Bank of America? Reese, I know this is not your area of expertise at all, but this really speaks to the importance of investigative reporting.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this foreclosure crisis is ongoing, and it's huge. It's affecting so many people and not really getting much attention.
Yeah, and it's difficult because it can get very technical. You have to spend a lot of time on it. So that leaves out most of the daily media. You rarely see that kind of investigative reporting. And for a few, occasionally the New York Times or some similar outlet will do it. But they have limited, even they have limited resources and limited. If it's going up against the Obama administration, who claims that they're trying to benefit people, there may not be the will to do it.
Well, and then again, if you don't have the investigative reporting that puts the pressure on the government, you might not see any action.
Yeah, exactly. I have to give a shout out to ProPublica because if people watch the show Treme on Showtime, or sorry, on HBO, there was a character, an ongoing character, who helped expose police brutality in New Orleans that was in ProPublica and was published in The Nation.
Oh.
So that's validation of all the great work that investigative journalists are doing.
Right, and that was, his name is escaping me.
A.C. Thompson.
Thank you. He's from San Francisco, A.C. Thompson. And that is Reese Ehrlich, award-winning investigative journalist who recently returned from Bahrain. And his pieces were in Global Post, also NPR, And we're joined by Paul Keel, an award-winning investigative reporter with ProPublica. He's been doing extensive reporting on the ongoing foreclosure crisis. And when you're talking about, like, for example, Reese, reporting from Bahrain, what is it like for you to get your pieces in places that will actually pay you so you can take these trips?
The conundrum of the freelancer. There's more outlets willing to publish your work as long as you don't need any actual money for it.
Right.
And the number of people who pay you serious money has decreased, but they are out there. So as a freelancer, what I do, Bahrain was actually relatively easy because it's so hard to get in there. So when I first got word that I might get a visa, I called up NPR. That day, they said, fine, if you can get the visa, you got the stories. And because I have a good ongoing relationship with him. I contacted the folks at Global Post, which is an excellent online newspaper out of the Boston area that covers international reporting. A lot of these folks, they get grants, they cobble together money, they're trying advertising. But in any case, they're able to pay decent money. And then finally, I went to the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, a nonprofit. The name Pulitzer might sound familiar to folks. And they were able to cover the expenses through a grant. So by cobbling all of this together, and I was able to actually make it work. And that's the freelancers. It's never been easy to be a freelancer. I've been doing it for many, many years. It's gotten more difficult in recent years, but there are people out there willing to pay serious money for serious reporting.
And how are things at ProPublica, Paul? Because this is a nonprofit investigative website, and we have reporters on from ProPublica on a regular basis doing extensive packages like you did on foreclosures.
Right, yeah, that's, I mean, we exist because there has been sort of a crisis and the amount of investigative journalism being done. So we have reporters who kind of came to us from various newspapers. I came up through a political blog, but we exist alongside newspapers. We're obviously a nonprofit. We're just here to do investigative work. We often partner with places like NPR or newspapers and that sort of thing, and it's kind of we're coexisting at this point.
Do you get financing through foundations or angel investors? How do you get your funding?
Yeah, we're mostly foundations, and we have been trying to diversify over the past several years and had a lot of success in that.
And so, for example, when you put out this large package about foreclosures, you know, in the old days, you would have like an ABC or another outlet building on top of it. Are you finding that? Are you getting interest from other outlets that say, oh, wait a minute, they have the resources to actually do this, so let's take advantage of it?
We don't charge for people to run our stories, so that is always attractive to news outlets. We also, basically, when stuff's on our site, in addition to sometimes, you know, kind of exclusively partner with one outfit, we also make it very easy for other outlets to rerun our stuff. So sometimes it is rerun in regional papers because we don't charge for that either.
And what sort of response do you get from these kinds of packages? Because, you know, we often hear from editors, well, we give the people what they want. And what you're giving the people are extensive, in-depth reports about issues that aren't really getting much attention. So what's the response?
I mean, I get a lot of positive feedback. I know that. I mean, there's been several million people who went through this, who experienced this firsthand, because we had a major crisis in this country that really doesn't have precedent dating, you know, the only one would be like the Great Depression. So there are people who, you know, live through this experience of trying to deal with their bank and being frustrated out of their mind and sort of feeling crazy because they didn't understand why, you know, Bank of America couldn't get a fax when they sent one. And so we've got a lot of gratitude from people just paying attention to this and staying on top of it.
And you ended one of your pieces saying, as the foreclosure crisis and the government's sputtering response enter their seventh year, ProPublica will be keeping watch. And today, on the front page of the Chronicle's business section, they've got a piece called New Rules on Home Loans, U.S. Consumer Agency Regulations Force Lenders to Make Sure Borrowers' Income and Assets Are Sufficient to Repay the Note. And they quoted Alice Cohen, a staff attorney with the National Consumer Law Center, saying that the new rules invite abusive lending and undermine the goals of the Dodd-Frank law. Have you been following this? And is this going to help homeowners who, frankly, got well, kind of screwed by some of these lenders who, you know, gave them AAA ratings or changed their salaries, for example.
Right. So this is part of a general process that was started by the big financial reform bill in 2010, and that is to kind of put new rules in place that would basically make the type of lending that was going on in the middle of the decade during the boom illegal. So that's the standards they're setting out, and there's been some, you know, criticism of that the loans that they're type of describing aren't really affordable. That's sort of, that's a process that's going on, and I mean, there already have been a lot of rule changes that would, if they had been in place in the middle of the decade, would have helped a lot, because there were really, you know, there was a lot of predatory lending going on, and there weren't very many protections for consumers.
And what are you working on now, Paul?
Well, I have to stay on top of this thing, because they haven't, the settlement has been announced, but they haven't given any details out. So we'll definitely have more on that in the next month. And I don't just cover mortgage stuff. I cover, you know, consumer finance issues more broadly. So there's a lot of stuff to cover.
Yeah. And what about you, Reese? What are you working on?
Planning a short speaking tour. It's the upcoming is the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the U.S. war in Iraq in March. So I'm doing a speaking tour around California and Oregon and Midwest. And then I'll be going back to the Middle East.
Where?
I can't say yet. Waiting for the visa.
Oh, okay. And what is the speaking tour focusing on specifically?
It's specifically, in some places I'll be talking about Syria and the uprising there and my experiences, and the other will be how the U.S. lost the war in Iraq.
Mm. Well, do you find that people are concerned about these issues even though we're not seeing them on the front pages unless there's
a
bombing?
I think, to be fair, people are more concerned about economic issues, and you get bigger turnouts for that. But yes, right. there is concern with U.S. intervention and Obama's policies. They want to come out. I spoke last night in Palo Alto to the Peninsula Peace and Justice Center, and good, lively discussion, very intelligent questions. And so, yes, people are interested.
That is award-winning journalist Reese Ehrlich, who recently returned from Bahrain. You can find his stories at yourcallradio.org. He's author of Conversations with Terrorists. Paul Keel is an award-winning investigative reporter with ProPublica, who's been extensively covering the ongoing foreclosure crisis. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What can we do to keep our streets safe from gender-based violence? On the next Your Call, we'll open the lines to air our concerns about sexual assault and violence. Every 2 minutes, someone is sexually assaulted in the U.S. More than half of assaults are not reported. A number of recent violent attacks in San Francisco are receiving widespread attention. So what steps should be taken to end the violence? Do you have a story to share? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Next time on Work with Marty Nemko, I'll talk with a key member of President Obama's obviously highly successful messaging team, Dr. Robert Cialdini, on the art of influencing. Plus, you can call in for a 3-minute career makeover, a workover, on Work with Marty Nemko, Sunday at 11. That's Sundays from 11 to noon here on 91.7 KALW. San Francisco.
This is local public radio, KALW San Francisco. Next, from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that, at noon, the Tavis Smiley Show, and then Smiley and West at 1. The time is 11 o'clock, KALW San Francisco. Good morning.
Hi, I'm Ros Atkins. Welcome to World Have Your Say from the BBC.
To stand there and face someone that has a shotgun, who's already discharged it and shot a student, that says, speaks volumes for these two young men.
Word of the latest school gun attack in the U.S. started coming through around this time yesterday. And in the 24 hours since, it's remained one of the most followed stories in the world. Now, thankfully, no one was killed this time, but one pupil was seriously injured. And again, the issue of how to keep schools safe is being passionately discussed. Now, this attack was ended by a brave and persuasive teacher. So we thought that we'd invite teachers around the world to join me and discuss the best ways to keep your schools safe. I wonder if you'd include guns in the solution.
You can't touch me, London.